Sunday. I know all of you will be there to join in the celebration of the installation of our minister, Amy. I'm asking that you think about perhaps coming early to join in the fellowship, to bring your loved ones and those that you know would love to be here. Come celebrate our joy. Don't forget, get the word out. It's next Sunday. So the timing, I think, is you ought to be here 1:30, 1:45. If it starts at 2, don't be late. Thanks.
Welcome into this safe and protective space where you do not need to fear the terror of night or the arrow that flies by day. Though in other places all may be strange or dark or confusing, here you can breathe deep and feel the warmth which shines like the sun and holds you in its embrace. Come, let us worship here together.
to life, guide us with the light of hope, the warmth of love, the beacon of purpose and meaning, because we are all afraid of the dark. Let there be light.
Unitarian Universalist Church. At LCUUC, we strive to surround this community with the spirit of love in everything we do. My name is Paul Fackler, and I'm the worship representative for this morning's service. We are a welcoming congregation. We celebrate your identity and what you bring to this community. Whether you dance to the monster mash of Bobby Boris Pickett, Michael Jackson's Thriller, or Warren Zevon's Werewolves of London, or feel that dancing should be strictly ballroom, or perhaps enjoy the simplicity of sitting still, we welcome you. Whether you were raised within a religion or raised by wolves,
or raised by scientists, or just touched by the noodly appendage of the flying spaghetti monster. We welcome you. No matter who you love or which pronouns you use to describe yourself, you are welcome here. We hope that all visitors, wherever they are on life's journey, and whatever their backgrounds, will find a lasting home here. Please join us for refreshments and conversation in our social hall after the service, and while you're there, stop by the welcome table to find out more about LCUUC. Be sure to take a closer look at today's order of service, which includes announcements of upcoming church activities. We look forward to all of our visitors, friends, and members joining in. Although electricity is important to life, at this time, please take a moment to silence any electronic tethers that you have attached to yourself today. And again, welcome to all here this morning. We are pleased that you have chosen to celebrate and worship with us today.
Here at LCUUC, we try to care for the wider community in several ways. And one of the ways we do that is by contributing to local food banks, both financially and through the collection of non-perishable food items, which we donate each month. If you've brought something to share today, please bring it forward at this point or invite a child to bring it forward for you. And I invite the children to stay up front for a story. Well, good morning. I don't know about you guys, but when I was a kid, one of the things I played was The Floor is Lava, where I had to run in and jump into bed. And another thing that I played was worrying about the monster under my bed. I was convinced there was something under there. Didn't matter how many times I looked or how often Mom and Dad told me, there's nothing under there. I was still pretty convinced, and it took me a long time to figure out, nah, there was nothing going to hurt me here. And a friend of mine, Margot Fallis, who lives in Australia, also kind of felt the same way, and she wrote this story called Monsters Under Your Bed. Mom, there's a monster under my bed, Gordon yelled. His mom came running in and turned on the bedroom light. Gordon, there's no monster. Get out of bed and look. He crawled out and he looked under really carefully. And have you guys ever do that?
No.
Nope. A smart kid. He keeps his feet in the bed. Oh, that's pretty smart too. Well, Gordon's bed was set up, and there was space underneath, and he said, Mom, I hear it breathing. I thought it was going to eat me, he said. Gordon, I don't know what you heard, but it wasn't a monster. You were just dreaming. She kissed him on the cheek and pulled up his covers, turned off the light, and went back to her room. Gordon lay in bed listening for sounds, and in a few minutes he heard, Arr! There it went again. He pulled the covers over his head, but the noises got louder. Remembering his mom had said there's no monsters, he got out of bed and turned the light on. He looked in his closet, nothing there, and then he got to his knees and looked under the covers under the bed. Hi, the monster said, and he slid out. Gordon was about to yell really loud when the monster said, Don't be afraid, I'm not going to hurt you. Gordon just stared. The monster was purple with big yellow spots, two big horns on the top of its head, sharp claws on its feet, and fat little fingers. Its lips were green and its eyes were orange, and without any warning, it started to cry. Gordon didn't know what to do. The monster was crying. "I'm lost," the monster said. "I'm hiding under your bed because it's warm and I don't know where else to go." "Who are you?" Gordon asked. "My name's Kevin. I live in a cave over by the lake. And this morning I went for a walk and I was chasing a bird, and the next thing I knew, I was lost. And then I saw your house, and I thought maybe you might be able to help me get home. But my mom looked under the bed. She didn't see you," Gordon said. "Well, I hid, and grown-ups don't see me very well. Will you help me get home?" "It's cold out," Gordon said. "Go back to sleep. I'll take you in the morning." Can you imagine telling the monster under your bed to be quiet and go to sleep? "But I'm hungry," the monster said. "Well, what do you eat?" "Well, I eat rocks and dirt and sometimes sticks." "Ew," Gordon yawned. "I don't have any of that. Let me go in the kitchen and see what I can find." The monster sat on the floor and picked up a few toys that Gordon had dropped. First, he put a rubber ball in his mouth and chewed that up. "Yuck," he said. Then he chewed on a toy truck. "This food is gross." Gordon came back carrying a plate loaded with cookies. "Here, try these," he said. "What is it?" said the monster. He put one in his mouth and, "Yuck! This is human food. Monsters don't eat this stuff." "Well, I'm sorry," Gordon said. "You'll just have to wait till morning. Let's go to sleep." When they woke up the next day, Gordon said, "Come on, let's get you back to your cave." And the monster yawned and stretched. His tummy growled, and the bright yellow spots on his skin turned even brighter. Gordon laughed. "Come on, let's go." They walked out toward the lake, and a bumblebee buzzed past them. Kevin tried to grab it, but he missed. Then he fell over two pink butterflies and accidentally grabbed a sticky thistle. "Come on," said Gordon. "Let's get you home. This monster wasn't scary at all." "There's the lake," Gordon said. "You're nearly home. Where's your cave?" "I don't know," Kevin said. "I think it's over there." They walked around the whole lake until they finally came to a cave. "Is this it?" Gordon said. "Yes," said Kevin. He ran inside and grabbed the biggest rock he could find. "Look, breakfast!" Gordon just shook his head. This monster wasn't much of a monster at all. Kevin invited him in for a breakfast of some worms and some dirt and a few rocks, but Gordon wasn't very excited about it. "That's okay, Kevin. I'm not hungry. I think I'll just go home now. Try not to get lost again." Gordon waved goodbye and headed back home. Later that night, as he lay in bed, he heard a noise. He was about to yell for his mom, but decided he better look for himself. And there was a new monster. "Who are you?" Gordon asked. "And what are you doing under my bed?" A skinny gray monster with a great big nose slid out from underneath. Its eyes were blue and the top of its head had lime green hair. "I'm Bill. Kevin said if I ever got lost, I should come to your house." "Oh, no," said Gordon. From then on, every night, a different monster showed up, and he didn't yell and he didn't cry. He knew they didn't eat people or even cookies. He just helped them find their way home. Didn't take long before he knew what they all ate and where they lived, and sometimes he would even wave to them on their way in. So if you ever think you hear a monster under your bed, just remember it's probably Kevin. And help him find his way home. And always keep a supply of rocks, just in case. Thank you for listening to my story. Would my lantern bearer come here? And would you all help me in singing the children out if you guys would follow him with the lantern? Unitarian Universalist minister, still new to preaching in public, went to preach at a congregation not her own. And after the service, a little boy found her in coffee hour, tugged on her robe, and said, "When I grow up, I'm giving all my money to the church." "Well, that's great," she said, fairly puzzled. "But why?" "Well, because my daddy says you're one of the poorest preachers we've ever had. And I figured you were all we could afford." The morning offering will now be given and received. Thanks for these gifts given and received for the life and work of this community. This is the time in our service where we share our joys and our concerns, and we do this in two ways. We speak them aloud and we light candles. Would anyone who has a joy or a concern to share, please raise your hand and the ushers will bring you a microphone.
My name is Claire. Please light a candle of concern for my sister-in-law. She is in the hospital with a severe head injury from a hiking accident yesterday.
Hi, my name is Janie, and my daughter is going to be married this weekend, this coming weekend, in Colorado on a horse. And I'd like to wish her joy and love.
My name is Tammy Wolfgram, and I'd like to light a candle of joy today because Rusty Borkin is here. For those of you who don't know, Rusty Borkin is working with Common Ground, and we're pretty excited at Common Ground because we're going to be taking on our first project, I guess you would say, this coming Thursday, is it, Rusty? And you can talk to him about that after church, and today is also, as you may have read in the order of service, designated collection for Common Ground, so I hope you'll dig deep, or you already did dig deep. Never mind.
Hi, I'm Dan Krill, and a candle of concern for my father, who's back in the hospital at Prater, Grandpa Tom. Right, Sully?
Yeah.
Hi, my name's Sean. This is coming Saturday. One of my old friends is getting married. I just wanted to share that for a candle of joy. Hope everything goes well for her.
If you'd light a candle for a young friend of ours who's struggling with depression and thoughts of suicide.
This is Lynn, a candle of concern for our friend Kathleen, who lost a sister tragically.
This is Terry, a candle of concern for my sister-in-law, who has ovarian and now liver cancer and surgery and is fighting for her life, and a candle of joy that I just put up the pasta party as an auction item.
Good morning, my name's Will, a candle of joy for the snow that calls us west.
Candle of joy, because I'm going to be a grandmother again.
And we light the last candle today for all those joys and sorrows which we hold deeply, but which we have not named here today. Would you please stand in body or spirit as you are able and join in singing our first hymn, number 1, May Nothing Evil Cross This Door.
And actually, I hate to do this to you, but I'm going to sit back down. This might not be a familiar name to it, though a lot of folks see those number 1 in the book, and actually it's my absolute favorite here. So we're going to go through it by 3 lines, and then the choir will sing, and we'll all sing together. It's going to be a name. First line is, May nothing evil cross this door. Okay, everyone? Thank you.
first reading today is an excerpt from Michael Weisselgrad's essay explaining theologian Martin Buber's work, I and Thou. I and Thou examines ethical responsibility in human relation. Buber's basic insight, an insight that runs through all his work and that determines his approach to everything he touches, is the realization that there is a basic difference between relating to a thing or to an object which I observe and to a person or a thou that addresses me and to whose address I respond. In its simplest form, this is the difference between the way people usually relate to inanimate things on the one hand and to living persons on the other. Inanimate objects are watched, while persons are spoken to. However, the distinction cannot be drawn simply on this basis. A person, as well as an inanimate thing, can be viewed as a thing, or in Buber's terminology, an it. Whenever we take an objective attitude toward a person, whenever we view him as part of the world and caught in its causal chain, we are in an I-it relationship, even though the object happens to be a person. The I-it relationship is characterized by the fact that it is not a genuine relationship, because it does not take place between the I and the it. When another person is an it to me, I am, first of all, perfectly alone. I gaze at him and view him from every possible direction. I observe his place in the scheme of things, and I find elements that distinguish him from them. All of this, however, takes place within me. I am judging, and I am observing, and the external world is relevant only to the extent that it enters my being. It is otherwise in the I-thou relationship. Here the relationship is genuine because it is between me and the thou that addresses me. This thou is no longer one thing among other things in the universe. The whole universe is seen in the light of the thou, and not the thou in the light of the universe. The I of the I-it is a different I from that of the I-thou, because it is not the I as such that has preeminent reality, but the relations of I-it and I-thou. The I appears and is shaped only in the context of some relationship with either an it or a thou, and can never be viewed independently of such a relationship. Buber further states that the I-it relationship is maintained with only part of ourselves in it. There is always a part of us that remains outside the relationship and views it from some vantage point. In the I-thou relationship, on the other hand, our whole being must be involved. Should I attempt to hold back any part of myself, I will find myself in an I-it situation, because there will be a part of me that is not participant, but spectator, a sure sign of the I-it. This means that the I-thou relationship carries with it much greater risk than the I-it, since there is no withholding of the self possible, as in the I-it. In the I-it situation, the part of the self that remains outside the relationship cannot be injured by the other party because he cannot reach it. In the I-thou relationship, there is no such security, because the thou of the I is addressed with the whole of the I, and any response elicited necessarily pertains to this total I. In the I-thou relationship, therefore, everything possible is risked without any defensive position being left to which the I can withdraw in the case of need. Here ends the first reading.
In his beautiful work, The October Country, American writer and alleged Unitarian Universalist, Ray Bradbury wrote, "It's poor judgment to call anything by a name. We don't know what a hobgoblin or a vampire or a troll is. Could be lots of things. You can't just heave them into categories with labels and say they'll act one way or another. That'd be silly. They're people. People who do things. Yeah, that's a way to put it. People who do things. People. Please join me in a moment of silent meditation or the spirit of prayer.
The second reading is from D.D.G. of the Hindu Radha Madhav Society. In his essay, See God in Everyone, G. says, "A man once heard in a lecture that God dwells within everyone. Thereafter, he genuinely made an effort to see God within every human and indeed every creature. As it often occurs, the poor man did not truly grasp the message in full. One day, a mad elephant came charging through the village in which the man lived. The elephant driver warned all the villagers of the impending danger. Soon, everyone was in a safe place, except for one man. This was the man who believed that God dwells within every living creature. He refused to seek the shelter and safety of his house and chose to remain outside. Soon the mad elephant came charging towards the same street in which the man was standing. Upon seeing the elephant, the man thought, 'This elephant is none other than God.' With outstretched arms, he welcomed the beast. The mad elephant trampled the man, leaving him with broken ribs and bones. As soon as it was safe to do so, villagers came out of their homes to the man's assistance. The elephant driver was amongst them. He asked the injured man, 'Why did you not get out of the way when I warned you? Everyone else did.' The man replied, 'I believe that God lives within everyone. I saw God in your elephant.' The elephant driver replied, 'Then, sir, why is it that you paid no attention to me? The same God who lives within the elephant lives within me, and that God was telling you to stay away from the elephant. See God within everyone, but realize at the same time that not everyone is beneficial for you.'" Here ends the second reading. Please stand in body or in spirit and join in the singing of hymn number 148, "Let Freedom Span Both East and West."
As some of you may have noticed when you came into the building today, it's almost Halloween. And Halloween, in its current form, has developed over centuries, beginning in Ireland long before Christianity, as the Gaelic festival of Samhain. Samhain marked the end of the harvest season and the beginning of winter, the dark half of the year, which balanced out the summer. It's celebrated about halfway between the autumn equinox and the winter solstice, from sunset on October 31st to sunset on November 1st. And along with Imbolc, Beltane, and Lusnach, it makes up of the four Gaelic seasonal festivals. Samhain came from Ireland, Scotland, and the Island of Man. And similar festivals were held at the same time of the year in Wales, Cornwall, and Brittany. The holiday is mentioned in some of the earliest Irish literature we've seen. And the date came to be a symbolic start point for anything mythical that happened. Just like in the Christian Bible, you often hear 40 days and 40 nights. In Gaelic literature, everything that was mystical and sacred happened on Samhain. It was a time when the cattle were brought back from the pastures and slaughtered for food, bonfires were lit, and rituals were completed for protection and cleansing. And the holiday was seen as a time when the doorway was partially open. The things you normally couldn't see were there with you. Fairies and spirits. Feasts were arranged, and the souls of dead family members were called to attend to be present with their family again. Food was piled on their plates and spaces were left for them. The problem was that these spirits or fairies were a little touchy, and if you didn't do it right, they could cause you harm. So most families made sure that even though it was good old Uncle Ben they were calling to sit with them, that they were ready to pay him off if things got ugly. We think that this led to the custom of guising, which became our modern day costuming. Children were dressed in costumes to hide them from the spirits or to confuse the spirits about whose kid was whose. And they went door to door, performing songs and dances and tricks, feats of strength, all in exchange for goodies of all kinds. When they got those goodies, they brought them back and they paid off those fairies, spirits of the dead, and other things that might be hanging around. And of course, these were all piled up and symbolically offered, and whatever the fairies didn't take, the kids ate the next day. So sugar highs were as big of a thing then as they are now. In the 9th century, the Roman Catholic Church shifted some of their holidays. All Saints' Day, which was a day dedicated to venerating all known Christian saints and martyrs, was moved to November 1st, and November 2nd became All Souls' Day, the day for remembering the departed Christian dead. All Saints and All Souls were known as Hallow Mass. And gradually they merged with Samhain at the end of the 18th century, and Halloween was created. The combination of Catholicism and Celtic lore left us with a lot of the elements still present today. Carved turnips and gourd lanterns were put out to light the way and scare off spirits. They became our carved pumpkins. The spirits of the dear departed became our white fluttery ghosts that sneak around yelling boo. And we left the fairies behind, generally and slowly adding the idea that this was the night when monsters came out to play. But what is a monster? Every culture and every country has their own set of scary creatures. Most created to prevent people from doing something you didn't want them to do. In England, Jenny Greenteeth was a watery monster who hung out in ponds and would eat small children if they went too close to the water. Sounds like a great way to keep your kid away from the lake. We are no different. Those of us who grew up before the gory, slashy films of the 80s can probably name a handful of well-known monsters without trying, whether or not we like scary stuff. The Wolfman, played by Lon Chaney. Michael Landon's teenage werewolf. Dracula. Frankenstein's monster and Elsa Lancaster as his lovely wife with her stylish hairdo. The Mummy. Phantom of the Opera and the Invisible Man. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Zombies and the Wicked Witch with the wart on her nose and the big hat. In the 50s, we had the Creature from the Black Lagoon, the Blob, the 50-foot woman, Godzilla and Mothra, giant ants in them, and giant bunnies in Night of the Lepus. We had space aliens and radioactive mutants. And since the 80s, types of monsters have exploded with relaxed movie ratings and increased exposure to international films. For those of you with children, and some of the rest of you, we've seen Freddy and Jason and Michael Myers, Carrie and Chucky, dangerous leprechauns, killer snowmen, sparkly vampires with stylish hair, cuddly werewolves with six-pack abs, psychopaths, maniacal mammals, revenge-driven sharks, homicidal trees, demented puzzle boxes, haunted houses, even an evil tooth fairy, and a sociopathic Santa Claus and his deadly elves. Not to mention hundreds of films and books that claim to be based on true crimes and real events that showcase human evil. But there's one common factor to these monsters. From the Invisible Man and his sunglasses and hat to the true crime villain, from the man-eating mutant to the razor-toothed sugar plum fairy, they are not like us. In his 1981 nonfiction work, Danse Macabre, Stephen King explored how we as a society address our fears through horror movies, books, and created monsters. He found that our trumped-up bogeys expressed our cultural terror. So when we feared radiation and bombs, we saw movies about atomic horrors, mutant insects, and Godzilla. In the 50s, when being normal was a national obsession, we saw movies about Wolfman giving in to animal urges, Frankenstein's monster behaving like an absolute bore, and Dracula expressing a weird, cold sexuality with his penetrative teeth and that strange European accent. The Cold War saw movies about pod people who looked like us. And the late 60s and early 70s brought out the religious films like The Omen and The Exorcist, following Time magazine, which asked if God was dead, and the rise of non-Christian religion in the U.S. Using fictional scares to allow the relief of real fear is normal, even healthy for many people. The books and the movies make it clear they are other. Monsters are outside and not human. Now, I grant that in some cases this is true. No one is claiming that an evil plastic doll or a 19-foot-tall rabbit is a person. The problem is that monsters began as just that, non-human scary things that behaved in non-human ways. And we called those dangerous non-human behaviors monstrous. But in the modern world, our belief in real monsters, non-human monsters, has almost disappeared in most developed countries. Instead, in a fit of circular reasoning, our definition of monster has become someone who has done something monstrous. Their behavior has made them a monster. They are no longer human. They are not like us. They are other. They are a monster. And when we use that word, we place whoever or whatever we are talking about squarely in that other category. The category where rules do not apply and where the mob and its torches are the good guys. It is easy to do. Murderers, rapists, serial killers, genocidal maniacs, terrorists. Look at what they did. They're not even human. They hurt people. They don't have emotion. How often have you heard it? They're an animal. They're a monster. Not like us. But that slope gets slippery quickly. They don't act human. They're not like us. They'll take your children. They hurt people. They'll get you if they're not careful. At one time or another, this has been said of various races, of Jews, Catholics. They drink human blood. Homosexuals, Romani travelers, even of suffragettes, immigrants, they're not like us. They're other. This is often an uneasy spot for Unitarian Universalists. How do we stand against monstrous behavior while still recognizing the inherent worth and dignity of the individual? How do we encourage justice, equity, and compassion, including for those whose behavior is unconscionable? How do we deal with those who have found a truth and a meaning in life which makes them unable to safely interact with human beings? How do we deal with the mad elephant? And how do we approach those places on our web which are dark and frightening and which we may be inclined to call evil? When we call a human being a monster, when we otherize them, we are avoiding these questions. It's too easy to make monsters of any person or group we don't understand or whose actions we find to be reprehensible. So if there are no human monsters, no human beings we can safely push away as outside of humanity, where does that leave us? And wise people through the ages have tried to address this. In the 18th century, a mystical rabbi, the founder of Hasidic Judaism, said, "There is nothing but God." This man, the Baal Shem Tov, who's also referred to as the Besht, his words form the foundation of my own belief. He said, "Nothing is separate from God, and everything, abstract or concrete, is a form in which the divine reveals itself. We are the divine is us." Our own William Ellery Channing, in his 1828 sermon, Likeness to God, also explored this. In that sermon, he says the spark of the divine can be found in every person, no exceptions. He called to the listeners of his time to acknowledge that spark in their interaction and in their relationships. He wanted us to cherish our own human nature as something both precious and holy. But he said that this divine spark is a call to a higher nature, a call to goodness and perfection, that we mirrored some kind of external God. And as much as we are in harmony with that mirror, we approach harmony with everything else. For us today, this is just one possible lens. Some of us believe in an external divine being. Some of us see human love or human spirit as the highest form of divinity. Some of us just go, yeah, I have no clue. Channing stressed that he wasn't calling on people to do anything outside of normal human experience. No hysteria, no acting strange. This was part of our nature. Normal people were part of this. He urged ministers to teach it from the pulpit, that this is just about being ourselves. And it's beautiful because it brings an incredible sense of optimism and hope no matter what. We are all one, gods and monsters, good and bad. There is divine. The Baal Shem Tov said that for this reason, you have to consider everybody good, and sins just have to be explained. His favorite saying was that no one has sunk too low to be able to raise him or herself to God. And he spent his life attempting to explain to those who made mistakes, to the monsters, that they were as close to the divine as anyone else, and any distance was the result of misunderstanding on their part, not a lack of love. Aravind Balasubramanian, a follower of the Hindu mystic Bhagwan Sri Sartha Sai Baba, explains his own teacher's modern approach to dealing with monstrous behavior. In his essay, Seeing God in Everyone, a Practical Approach. And this really kicks back to the Martin Buber I Thou thought. Aravind explains that as we relate to one another as embodied human beings, we are called to remember that we have only our human, fleshly, me-centered perspective. He compares this to the experience of seeing a movie, in contrast to being on the set and seeing the filming of a movie. So let's take, for example, The Wizard of Oz. If we are seated in a theater, we watch as Dorothy, the heroine, combats the evil Wicked Witch of the West. Over and over, they match wits until at last Dorothy kills her with a well-placed bucket of water. The witch's behavior is terrible. One might even say she's monstrous. As human beings, from our perspective as viewers of the action, we judge and distance ourselves. If the events were real, we would move to protect ourselves. But if we change our perspective, say we are on the set as the movie is being filmed, we watch as the witch confronts Dorothy and the Scarecrow, threatening to burn the straw man, and then the bell rings and the actors break for lunch. In a few minutes, we see Dorothy and the witch seated side by side, reading lines of script and sharing a soda. In fact, if you could read their minds while they were filming the scenes, they have no dislike, no hatred. They are each aware that the other is playing the role they have been given. This, Aravind says, is the secret to seeing the divine in everyone, no matter what their behavior. Don't tie yourself to seeing only the role another human plays, God or monster. Each person, through genetics and upbringing, life situation and learning, assumes a role and a character in the great play that encompasses all life. Hate the role. Fight against the workings of the character. Stay off the set if the character is too dangerous. Some roles are a threat to anyone around. But recognize that you are only seeing the movie. Recognize that the monster is only the makeup, only the character. Do not hate the actor. Do not lose sight of their divinity because of the role they have been given to play in this world. Under all of the makeup, behind the lines, is a human being who is more than the character they have been given. See Channing's face of the divine under the hair, claws, fangs, and fright wig. We are all human. Gods and monsters. We are all divine. Amen. And we've got a moment for a brief polylogue, so if anyone has anything, please raise your hand and the usher will bring you a microphone.
Hi, I'm Carrie Silverman, and yesterday Tony and I went to see Ragtime at the Rep, and it's exactly the same theme, and it plays out, unfortunately, with a very sad way that human beings look at each other, and it's a powerful, powerful story, so really related to what you said. Thank you.
Hi, I'm John. I wanted to thank you. It seems kind of timely to me as I look back on what we just went through with the whole budget and debt debacle with the government shutdown, and how easy it is to fall into this looking at and demonizing the individuals on the other side, whichever side we might fall on, and makes it a little easier to come back and say, well, these are people too, and to remember it's their actions we don't like. Thank you.
Ivan, and I certainly don't claim to be able to live what I think in my head, but I think in my head that people who do hurtful and monstrous looking behaviors are missing the connection with others, and we connect with some others, but I think not connecting with the bigger picture is how it plays out. That disconnect is the response to, in an evil, hurtful way, is a disconnect with a bigger other.
When I was listening to the It, Thou part, I instantly thought of dating. when you meet someone for the first time, they are more of an it, and as you work towards developing that relationship, they become a thou. And so it kind of hit me that there is a place for both. So we shouldn't be necessarily always trying to be in thou relationships. It is a protective thing. It's a initial confrontation type reaction. But I think the message may be that we should work to change our it relationships to thou relationships whenever we're dealing with people.
Robin, and I'm amazed at this because all last week I was playing out all these stories that you have been talking about, and it's been my whole lifetime work to bring these old stories to life. You really told them quite well, I'm planning to go back into doing it again, and I've been interrupted a little bit, but now I'm gonna go back and do the thing I've been loving to do my whole life. So, and you hit it on that. Okay.
I'm Dave, and I'd also like to thank you, Amy, for bringing this topic up. It seemed very sort of lighthearted, but it really was very profound. And as you were speaking, I was reflecting on my role as a parent, where it's very easy to have that unconditional love, and you know, no matter what this person does, you're still, you know, supportive of them and loving them. As a teacher, it becomes very challenging because there are so many students that you're with every day, and they're not as close to you. But it is something that I've reflected on in my professional life, just to keep that distinction. You know, the behavior is not acceptable; the person is, and so working with that gave me some new perspectives on how to approach that. Thanks.
Thank you, Amy. This is Lynn. I'm thinking you could have named the sermon Standing on the Side of Love.
I do have concern about how when people are trying to discriminate you in one way or the other, that they have to put those people in one category. And I am very concerned about how the president of this country is being put in the category of other. It's just amazing to me that we could do this to a president of our country.
Thank you, everyone. We can carry on conversations in the social hall after the service. We extinguish the chalice here, that it may glow gently in our hearts. May it light your path as you leave this place. May it guide your way until we are together again. Please stand in body or spirit and join in the singing of hymn number 295, Sing Out Praises for the Journey. And please remain standing for the benediction.
Go into the world with new lenses, seeing everyone as they are. Be unafraid to look beyond mask and makeup, shell or seeming, and wherever you go, may there be love, peace, and may it be so.